You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Seven 33 on a Thursday. That is Carlos Santana featuring Michelle Branch. Quick check of the weather around the Marine Corps. 85 and partly cloudy at Camp Lejeune. 29 Palms, 81 under sunny sky. It's 110 in Fallujah as night begins to get ready to fall. Hawaii, early morning, 75 degrees and cloudy. Camp Pendleton, 67 and cloudy. 72 and cloudy in Quantico. 84 degrees and cloudy in Okinawa. Joining me this morning is Mike Grice, the Marine officer, writer, Lethwich winner, combat leader, and now businessman. So Mike Grice, who Mike Frazier has a straight up man crush on, I might add. I just want to get that out in the open and on the record so that Frazier could rebut that for the rest of his life. But I'm sure he won't. He'll just admit to it. So, Mike, first of all, thanks for taking time out of your morning and joining us here on All Marine Radio.
No, it's a privilege. I appreciate the opportunity to talk.
All right. First of all, Mike, we need to learn about you. So born and raised where?
I was born actually in Albuquerque, New Mexico, but grew up in a town called Broomfield, Colorado.
Albuquerque is beautiful. I mean, that whole like northern tier of Arizona through northern New Mexico. How old were you when you left New Mexico?
I was the ripe old age of 6 weeks, so unfortunately I didn't get a lot of hiking in. But growing up in Colorado was a very close second.
One of the healthiest states in the country.
Yep.
How about that?
Absolutely.
Why? Why is everybody so active in Colorado?
You know, it's interesting. I have no idea. But one thing I will say is that I live in Southern California now,
right,
where it's easy to be active. In all the places that I've lived around the world, around the United States, one thing that was consistent living in Colorado is people continued to be active regardless of the weather. So you have people outside, you know, jogging, running, playing softball or whatever. In the summer, they're the same people who are skiing, backpacking, you know, doing all kinds of snow sports in the winter, and they're camping in the fall and all that. So I think that the population kind of as a general rule was active all year round. And I think that has a lot to do with it. When I lived in Northern Virginia or I lived on the East Coast and other parts of the world, yeah, you just didn't see people as active in the not-so-nice months of the year. That'd be my guess. Could be wrong.
I just got a text message that said, Matt, could you ask the colonel if he thinks that the legalization of marijuana and all the pizza that will be ingested will impact the health of the people in the state of Colorado?
So you know, it's an interesting question. So I'll divert for just a second here. I grew up there and then left, you know, as I came on active duty. So my life in my snapshot of California is up into the 80s, into the early 1990s.
Okay.
And it was a very healthy state then. And we ate a lot of pizza, but we did a lot of outdoor stuff as well.
Right.
Going back, my mom still lives in the same house I grew up in. I try to get back to see her every couple months or so.
That's awesome.
There's a couple changes in the demographics which are interesting. One is that there's a very large increase in the homeless population. And anecdotally, that's because a lot of people, because marijuana is legal there, there's a lot of people who are on the very bottom end of the demographic spectrum. Space that are moving to Colorado for that reason, which could impact the healthy numbers in the future. But my friends who've lived there their whole lives say that there's three kinds of people in Colorado. There are the people who smoked weed before, and they smoke a whole lot more weed. The people who didn't smoke weed, they still don't smoke weed. And those who are going to try it, they generally try it and they kind of move on with their lives. So I think it may end up balancing out because the healthy folks are going to continue to stay healthy and be healthier. The ones who are doing a ton of weed, you know, if you do a ton of weed, you may not be able to eat enough to stay healthy, you know, and at least enough to stay, you know, not fat, I guess, because a lot of people smoke a lot of weed. Anyway, that's your question, I guess, maybe, which is a completely non-answer, but it'll be interesting to see what happens.
I would ask you, you sound like you followed this issue a little bit. How do you breathalyze marijuana? I mean, you have to take them down and do a blood test. I mean, so if you're driving erratically because you're stoned, how do you police that?
Any That's idea? A great question, and I'm not sure that they've come across a thoroughly effective way of doing so. One of the challenges that the state faces, and I think that every state is going to face as they legalize marijuana, because more are certainly going to be doing so,
yeah.
is that how do you police actions that are very easy to police now? I mean, driving while intoxicated with alcohol is an easy one right now. But how do you, when someone's, for example, when a police officer sees you drinking a beer in your car, that's an open container. When they see you smoking something in your car, they don't know if you're smoking marijuana or if you're smoking a cigarette. So it brings the policing factors into a realm of ambiguity that's creating some issues, because there isn't, from what I understand, talking to my friends who still live there, there isn't a test that's as easy and rapid as a breathalyzer test. There are also the pro-marijuana advocates say, you just get stoned, you're mellowed out, you're going to be a better driver because you're going to be going 5 miles an hour down the interstate.
Right.
But the practical reality is that it creates a whole new set of problems and unintended consequences that I know Colorado is still wrestling with and trying to figure out what that means. And there are other unintended consequences that come with that as well. There is a healthcare crisis, 5 and 10 years down the road. When, people start exhibiting lung cancer and emphysema and breathing related issues that come from smoking essentially filterless cigarettes, a lot. So there's a lot of things that they are wrestling with that the state is making money hand over fist in the tax department because they're taxing the crap out of it.
Right.
Which is helping fill the state coffers. However, as I said, 10, 15 years from now, what is the effect on coffers going to be when they're paying for those unintended consequences
the healthcare,
that they're going to be facing?
Interesting. You hear the humorous anecdotes. I heard Peyton Manning. Somebody asked him, "Hey, how's the pizza business?" He said, "It's awesome, man." He said, "I kid you not. I mean, since the legalization of marijuana in Colorado, our business has gotten better." So he said, "Colorado, a good state." So, but yeah, as you said, the serious part of it. I first saw an article in about the whole breathalyzer urinalysis. What do we do after a fatality in the state of Washington? That was blamed on a driver who was under the influence of marijuana, and it was, I want to say, there was 3 fatalities in it, and so they talked about the problem of it, the problem that police officers have with it, and that there wasn't a good, quick way that you could breathalyze, if you will, marijuana, and so that law enforcement were looking to find something, without having, do I have to do a urinalysis out here, or do I have a portable urinalysis so I can see if you have THC in your system, and if that was, if you do have it in your system, from how long ago do you have it in your system? So it was just a series of issues. But anyway,
I
digress. So Mike, where'd you go to college?
I got my undergraduate at the University of Colorado at Denver. Mm-hmm. And I got a master's degree in military science and land warfare from American Military University. And I got my MBA from the University of Southern California.
Go Trojans! How did
That's
you?
Right, on.
How did the Marine Corps get on your radar?
Oh, geez. I was a kid. I was born in 1967. So when I was very young, I distinctly remember the news reports from Vietnam on TV when mm-hmm. my folks would watch the news every night and seeing helicopters fly around and stuff like right. that. So I think that was part of the nascent intrigue with the military. And then, growing up in the 70s and 80s, watching every war movie that was ever made, I kind of made the decision that at some point I wanted to go in the military. As it got closer, as I was in high school, getting ready to figure out what I was going to do with the rest of my life, I decided, hey, I'm going to enlist in the Marines. Kind of looked at all the other services and the chutzpah of knowing everything when I was 17, I was like, I've got to go with the toughest, got to go with the Marines. So, toddled down to the recruiters and enlisted. I actually enlisted in the reserves, so I go to college. And from there, had a great, went to recruit training at MCRD San Diego and swore an oath I would never, ever go back there because it was a detestable, miserable time in boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
Then went on and was in the reserves. So I went through college, finished college and got my commission and went to Quantico and OCS and moved on from there.
Wow, interesting. Now, I very much the same way. There was no Marines in my family. I just saw them in Southern California when my dad was actually working for the Padres. I'd see them, and they were always so squared away. And then I had read about the war in the Pacific. I was joking today. Today's my mom's birthday. She passed away a couple of years ago. And, you know, I used to be part of the Scholastic Book Club and, you know, go to and buy those books at school. And and I would always read, you know, about war in the Pacific, Wake Island, you know. And that's how the Marine Corps got on my radar as well. Interesting. Mike, I want to ask you, I mean, you have a – you know, you've commanded, you know, Anglico units. You're MOS, or you're an artilleryman, yes?
Yeah, I was an O-802. Okay. When I was enlisted, I was an 0844 and an 0848, which is a field artillery fire controlman and artillery operations chief. And when I went to OCS and TBS, selected artillery officer 0802, and was an 0802 for my entire commissioned service, but also had the additional MOS of 8002, which is a joint terminal attack controller.
Which is
what I actually did most of my work with when I was in combat overseas.
Okay. Let's talk about your combat tours. When and where?
My first combat tour was I was a brigade platoon commander with 1st Anglico, which nobody really understands what that means. I can explain a little bit in a minute. But I went to Ramadi, Iraq from August of 2005 to March of 2006, came home. Trained up, went back to Ramadi in August of 2006, got home in March of 2007, came home for 7 months. Then I deployed as an individual augment to Special Operations Command, where I went to Qatar and Kabul, Afghanistan in December of 2007 through June of 2008. Then I actually got a whole year between deployments and then went to Helmand Province, Afghanistan with 1st Anglico. And we started our force flow, I don't know if you remember this, but around Thanksgiving of 2009, President Obama announced that he was going to do a surge and 30,000 troops were going to be going into Helmand Province. Well, my unit was on the front end of that. So we started flowing forces before Thanksgiving and I got my feet on deck over there around New Year's 2010, came back in June of 2010.
Yeah, I got there in August of 2010. So
just missed
you. The all right, let's talk about this whole Ramadi. What a place back in the day. I want to start by talking to you about you're obviously recognized the Lefkowitz Trophy for everybody in the Marine Corps that knows it's a leadership award for company grade officers. It goes to the top. So the person selected as a top leader, and the guys I know, guys like Chris Bronzy that have won it, I mean, are incredible guys, and Mike Grice has won that award. Talk about how that happened, Mike, and I'm sure that you give a lot of credit to a lot of other people, but where did you learn the leadership that you've obviously practiced? Were you fortunate to have great mentors when you were young? Is it something that, you know, you got from your parents? Where do you lay credit for that?
I don't know. That's a very interesting question. Because I really think I spent a whole career studying leadership kind of on its face. You know, I always ask myself a question that one of my drill instructors used as his definition for leadership is a leader who is somebody who can get something to do something that they don't want to do, but to look forward to doing it. So that's kind of my definition of leadership is how does somebody, inspire can be a bit of a hackneyed word, but how do you really get someone deep down to be willing to pick up a rifle and take a hill knowing that they may not make it to the top? And to do it with a clear conscience, an open soul. And it sounds a little bit deep, but that kind of had been the cornerstone of what I would guess if I had a leadership style, it would be that. Is that it's never about you, the person in charge. It's always about, you know, accomplishing what, in the case of the Marine Corps, what did the Marine Corps put the unit that I'm in place to do. So everything that I've ever done has been focused on accomplishing the mission of the unit to which I was assigned. And so every question that I answered, every order that I ever gave, not that I really, I'm not a big fan of, I think at one point in my career did I ever say, I'm giving you a direct order. But to create that environment in which Marines and sailors and soldiers and airmen, when you're working with them, Coast Guardsmen even, they get it, they understand it, and they do the right thing when you're not watching, but more so, they do the right thing because they believe it's the right thing. So, you know, how did I kind of come to that realization? It came over time. I think there's probably two or three creditable influences that helped me distill that particular leadership philosophy. Some would be unexpected. So before I joined the Marine Corps, I worked at McDonald's. And I credit no small part of the leadership skills that I used in the Marine Corps in combat to things I learned while I was flipping burgers and bagging fries. And one of the probably the most distinct lesson that I learned from that is that you have to be able to work with other people. And if you view people when you assume a management or leadership position, if you assume the mindset that people work for you, that's a very limiting thing. Because if you cannot, Evans Carlson from Carlson's Raiders, mm-hmm. He used the term gung-ho,
right.
Which is a Chinese term that means roughly work together. Mm-hmm. That became kind of my mindset that I learned at McDonald's. We all have to work together. Because, you know, if the fry person's not making fries, customers aren't going to get fries, everybody's going to get pissed off, and all of our lives are going to suck because we're going to get yelled at. So let's just do it better. Let's work together. Let's all work towards a common objective and then be successful. So I learned that working with an entire vertical slice of the American population, from people who were in their 40s and nothing else had worked for them, and they were bagging fries at McDonald's, to 16-year-olds like me who were just kind of starting out in life and wanted to get money for beer and to be able to drive a car around. So that was one lesson that I learned that I actually didn't learn in the Marine Corps. Because as I went into the Marine Corps, the perspective on leadership was very bifurcated. The officer corps set policy, made decisions, and issued directives, and kind of put that big blue arrow out there. And the enlisted corps saw where that big blue arrow was supposed to go, and they actually got there. But the leadership techniques were very, very different. I worked when I first came to the Marine Corps, we'd been at peace for a long time, and it was a very autocratic. You know, PFCs did what Lance Corporals told them to do. Lance Corporals did what Corporals told them to do, kind of up the chain.
Mm-hmm.
And in the mid-1980s, promotion was very slow, so we actually had an extra rank, which we called the Senior Lance Corporal. So we have, you know, 15 non-rates. Well, the Senior Lance Corporal was the guy who found out what the corporal wanted and made all the, you know, all the Oompa Loompas in the chocolate factory go do it. So that's the first credit. The second credit I would give would be the Marine Corps is a pure meritocracy, or as pure a meritocracy as you can get. And the leadership lesson I took from that is, in order for you to be a proficient Marine, you have to know your craft. You have to be a professional. You know, if you're a cook, your goal every day should be to be the best cook in the Marine Corps. And you can never be good enough because there's always more to learn. I took that on as an enlisted Marine and as an NCO and as a staff NCO and then as a company grade field grade officer, is that you cannot lead if you cannot do. I'll give you an example of this, so I don't monologue too long, but when I was a gunnery instructor at Fort Sill, Oklahoma, I taught second lieutenants from the Army and the Marine Corps about artillery. And I had one kid, he's a Marine, and he was a graduate of the Citadel. And we're out in the field doing a training exercise, and he really wasn't into being an artilleryman. He did enough to get by. You know, he passed his classes and all that type of stuff. And we're out there, and I'm talking with him, and he stands up, and he kind of assumes that Napoleon, you know, the Napoleon pose of, you know, shoving his hand into his blouse and looks around to all that he surveys and commands. And he says, I'm a leader. I cannot wait to get out to the fleet so that I can lead Marines. And I ask him, where are you going to lead them to? Because if you're not the best or aspiring to be the best artilleryman in the Marine Corps, they're not going to follow you. They'll do what you say, but there's a huge difference between having somebody do what you say and having someone follow your lead. So the second portion, I suppose, is always aspiring to be the best. And it's not to say I'm better than you are, but it's a duty to your Marines and sailors. You have to be the best because the capital that you expend as a leader is human lives. And if you aren't as good as you can possibly be and someone dies on your watch, it's your fault. So I firmly believe that. And the third would be mentors. You know, people like Mike Frazier. You know, he's Daddy Frazier. We're all his children.
He has a man crush on you, but did you really have to go there?
It's true. You know, we're all his children. If you're in the artillery community and you're not one of Mike Frazier's children, then you're an outsider, and you know. There's another whole conversation there.
Well, you want to know what you are? Because the way you become one of his children is you earn your way, as you just said. It's a meritocracy.
It is.
Absolutely. Let me tell you, and he doesn't waste his time. If you're not a player, you're not one of his kids, all right? You're one of the other people and he's respectful and a great guy, but it's that meritocracy. It's like, you know, in the Marine Corps, there's groups of guys in any era of the Marine Corps. It's like, how do you guys know each other? Because they all know each other. You know, it's like, you know him, he knows you, he knows him. And they're not the same MOSs either. It's because they're ballers. They play.
Right.
You know, when the Marine Corps goes, they put up numbers. And I don't care if you were doing CACs or I don't care if you were doing manpower. There's guys who show up and they carry the load. And those guys know each other. And as they migrate through the Marine Corps, that group links to each other. And they wind up, you know, to a great extent, running the Marine Corps, because they're proven guys under pressure in the meritocracy that Mike Grice talks about. Anyway, Mike, continue.
You're absolutely right. It's kind of as the side for that point, the point that you just made. There's some guys that I worked for. One guy who wasn't a particularly good leader, but he was a good dude. I was his XO. He was a battalion commander. And his actual favorite thing was recruiting. You know, he was an artilleryman, but his thing in the Marine Corps was recruiting. He wanted to get back to recruiting. And later on, I think he ended up commanding a recruiting district, and it was great. But as an artilleryman, he was a perfectly acceptable, passable, artilleryman. But his measure of effectiveness was, as he said, can you turn product? Can you grind? Can you get in there and just do whatever it takes to get done what needs to get done? And that was an important lesson for me to learn and kind of reinforce the things that I thought, because the people that you were just talking about are the ones who do that. The ones who, irregardless of circumstance, irregardless of task, they understand the purpose and they just do whatever it takes to get that purpose accomplished.
And Frazier's gifted as a leader. I remember being in a staff meeting with him. He was the chief of staff and he hated long staff meetings. So, you know, people start to bloviate, and he would just stop them. He's like, Doc, is that all you got? And he would say, this is a quote, your shit is weak, Doc. All right, who's next? All right, Deuce, don't go where he went. All right, what do you got for me? And he would, with his sense of humor, using it to kind of keep this thing moving, he always had this kind of little bit of edge to him, and he was not afraid to do it in public either, that made you show up and be better. And then he kind of teased you afterwards, but you knew what he wanted, and if you continued to defy it, you know, well, you worked with him, right? You'd get called in and say, hey, what are you doing, man? I'm trying to help you out, but don't do this in public, really. And so it's Frazier.
Yeah, he was usually a lot more direct in private. As an aside, he wears my kids out too, so it's pretty funny.
He wears you. He does that with everybody. And he's just like this machine gun kind of comedy show with editorial comments laced into every round that he shoots. And I've got an email for you, Mac. I think that this guy is way too smart to be on your show. Where are the grunts this morning? You know what? We don't need to go there. Mike got a grunt. Mike Grice, our guest, this morning on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. Mike, I interrupted you. So who else instrumental in terms of, you said Mike Frazier, and we've ridiculed him enough. So who else instrumental in developing you as a leader?
I learned a lot from John Lukeman. He was my BLTCO when I was at BLT 25, 31st MU. He was a very short version of what could be a much longer story. Is we deployed to Okinawa. We had our BLT commander, Rick Detterke. It's for 31st MU, you kind of cobble everybody together at the last minute and you get on the island and you kind of roll from there. Rick Detterke's son was diagnosed, I believe, with leukemia. So he had to go home and take care of his family. So we got a new BLT, new battalion commander, new BLT commander, like on week two of our deployment to Okinawa in 2001. And John Lukeman came in. Nobody knew him from Adam. I later found out that his father was the commanding general of the recruit depot when I was a recruit, which is an interesting aside. He came in cold, just feet absolutely ice cold. He was driving across country, was getting ready to take over 3-5, got the call that many of us get when we're PCSing. Hey, we need you here right now because of this. He literally parked his family, got on a plane, came over to Okinawa and said, "Here I am. I'm the guy in charge." So,
wow.
And he got up and he had the sagacity to not say anything. He showed up. He said, "We're going to execute the training schedule that's been set. We're going to get ready to train. This is before 9/11. You know, we're going to do what we're here to do." Okay, that's awesome. The week after he gets there, we have our first BLT training hike. So we were at Camp Hansen. We were going to go to the CTA up to, I think it was LZ Bluebird or something like that. It was a 6-mile hike. Not a big deal.
Right.
So, but it's Okinawa and it's August. So it's,
which means it's hot.
It's plenty hot. Yeah. And it's anybody who's been in Okinawa in July and August, you know, it sucks.
And
it sucks a lot.
It's humid before you walk into the woods.
Yeah. Well, my role as a battery commander, I was a young, tube R. And I was an artilleryman, so I was a bolt-on. I was artillery battery commander working with one of the most storied battalions in the Marine Corps. My rule was we never do anything for the first time with the grunts. So if we were going on a hike next Saturday, the Saturday before, my battery got on the road and we went and did that hike so that we would be prepared, so that, we would not go up and, show our ass on one side of it. But the other side was to show that we as artillerymen, we are part of the BLT. And to be part of the BLT means we can do everything that you can do. So fast forward a week, and we're on our first hike with the BLT. John Lukeman, Lieutenant Colonel Lukeman, is standing out front. This is his first exercise with BLT 25. So we head off. A good friend of mine, Jim Wolf, was the OPSO. We'd gone to AWS together.
I taught Wolf.
That great dude. Great American.
He's a great guy.
So we step off, and we're about 2 miles into it, and it is hot. It's, it's 100 degrees. It's at night. It's like you're wearing a heated, wet wool blanket. It's just miserable. So about the two-mile mark, I remember seeing a machine gunner, and he's got the I don't remember if we had 240s then or if we had pigs. He's got his machine gun over his shoulder, and he's having an interesting conversation with Jesus, and I'm not kidding, as he falls back through our ranks.
Ooh.
And just like, ooh, this isn't good.
Yeah,
we get up
good.
To the LZ, and this is 3 miles out, and it's almost a mass casualty drill. There are people all over the place. There's IVs getting thrown up, but it's not catastrophic. It's like, wow, this is tougher than we thought. All we got to do is turn around. We got to make it back to Hansen. I'm like, okay. So we give a report. Battery didn't lose anybody. A couple of companies had lost people. Some of the attachments, or whatever. So like, okay, so we go in, we drink water, we take an E, do all those things that you do, and then we start heading back. Well, as we're heading back, the wheel's completely ejected from the bus. So there are bodies in the ditches, they run out of IV bags, the meat wagon is getting filled up with people going all the way back, coming back up, just shuttling back and forth, and we're just hiking down the road. So we were, as an attachment, I think we were the third to last or second to last unit, maybe even the last, to actually participate, actually in the line of march.
Step off.
And we are, we're walking along. There are saws in the ditch. There are rifles laying in the road. And there are IV bags everywhere. There's equipment everywhere. We keep humping. We get into the big grass parade field.
Mm-hmm.
We stop. Mm-hmm. We take a drink of water, and I go report to the BLTCO. Mr. Hazers, Cam Grice, Echo Battery, we're here, you know, just reporting that we're done. He said, well, how many did you lose? I said, sir, what do you mean? He said, well, how many of your Marines did make it? And I said, we're all here, sir, all of us. We didn't lose anybody. Well, we were the only unit in the BLT not to lose someone. So over 50 Marines and sailors were in the hospital because of heat prostration. And that, I think, is probably a seminal moment in my career in that I didn't do that. My Marines did, and my sailors did. And the reason that they did it is because they understood that to be part of a Marine Infantry BLT, you had to be able to do what Marine infantrymen did. So we always made sure that we were prepared. And as a result of that preparation, and as a result of every Marine and sailor knowing how important it was, Echo Battery crossed the line with everybody there as the only unit in the BLT that did. So that was started a fantastic deployment for us because it gave us a tremendous amount of credibility. But the thing that I learned from John Lukeman was he looked at me and said, Roger that, thanks, go tell the opso. But was able to look at the situation, recognize that it wasn't because the battalion was poorly trained to go on deployment. The problem was people weren't acclimated. They hadn't really prepared for that arduous of a hike that early in the deployment. Hey, 6 miles, you know, right. You can do that staying on your head. Yep. But he recognized that we had put forth the extra effort, and he recognized that there were some things that needed to be done to make sure that everybody was prepared to train on Okinawa. So, you know, he didn't single us out. He didn't single us out and say, hey, you guys did a great job. But what he did do was demonstrate through his actions and his leadership that the standard that people should follow was the standards that we had set as an artillery battery. You know, the artillery battery was successful in a way that the infantry companies weren't. So that type of mentorship in that, you know, not cheerleading, rah-rah, you did an awesome job, but recognition of a job well done and making sure that other people meet the standard that really needs to be met, that's an incredible and powerful lesson to learn.
My guest this morning is Mike Grice, Marine officer, 27-year career, and we're talking to him about leadership right now. We're going to take a quick break. And Mike, we're going to take a couple-minute break and then come back, and I want to talk current events in the Marine Corps, get your thoughts on things that are going in the Marine Corps, and I want to talk a little bit about decision-making, something I think you and I both have in common. So we'll continue with Mike Grice right after this on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio right here on the All Warrior Radio Network.
AV to all returning veterans, thank you. Thank you for doing your duty. Thank you for doing our bidding. Thank you for laying it all on the line. Thank you for stepping up and not backing down. Thank you for putting your future on hold to put our enemies on notice. Thank you for putting your buddies' lives ahead of your own. Thank you for putting yourself in harm's way. Thank you for defending our freedom, for displaying your honor, for being a hero, even though you don't want to be called one. For all this and more, DAV thanks you, and we're here to help you. Expert DAV advisors will make sure you get the health, disability, and financial benefits you were promised and earned. If you're a veteran, visit DAV.org for free help. And again, thank you.
America, let me tell you about Sergeant Greg Anderson. Served two tours in Afghanistan, Bronze Star and Purple Heart recipient, and unemployed. The unemployment rate among transitioning service members is unacceptably high, much higher than the general population. Veterans are a proven commodity. They're mature, reliable, and hardworking. They deserve a chance to get back to work after serving their country. Do you really want to honor a veteran? Hire one. Go to legion.org/honorveterans to find out how you can help.
Military life is rewarding, but it isn't always easy.
Managing the stress can affect even the strongest warrior.
But I can, I will stay mission ready.
I can, I will
keep my mind and body fit.
Talk to my chaplain.
Seek care early.
Strive for progress, not perfection.
I got this.
I got this.
Take the first step.
There's no better time than now.
Reaching out is a sign of strength. Visit realwarriors.net or call 800-874-2273.
to be fully fit, you have to be physically fit. You also have to be mentally fit.
I wish that more warriors would realize how important it is if you get the psychological support that you need so that you can focus on the rest of your life.
I think it takes strength in order to admit that you have an issue. But it also takes intuitiveness of a friend, a leader, a supervisor to pick up on the signal that the soldier is having issues and needs to seek professional help in dealing with it.
It's also important for the lowest possible levels of leadership to be very supportive in helping their members get the help that they need.
When I went to get help, I had more help than I could ask for from my entire command.
It's sometimes challenging to come to a senior staff member or senior officer in the unit with a problem. There's not a commanding officer out there or a leadership staff out there that doesn't want to help. So don't hesitate. Come ask.
Learn more by visiting www.realwarriors.net or calling 1-866-966-1020.
You're listening to All Marine Radio on the All Warrior Radio Network.
Minutes after 8 here on the West Coast. That means it's 9 minutes after 11 on the East Coast. We continue. Mike Grice, our guest, 27-year Marine officer and enlisted Marine. A career that's that tremendously impressive when you read it. And he's been gracious enough to join us here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. Mike, I want to ask you about you've taught at a number of different schools, and I got very interested in decision making, compressed time, high stress environment that is very unique to the United States military, probably to police, firefighters. Not too many people live in that world. You've taught a lot of leadership. Is there a part of teaching leadership that you really got excited about, and you're an award-winning writer. Is there an aspect of leadership that kind of fascinated you that you really wanted to explore as an instructor and a writer?
Well, I think that's a great question, and again, it goes back to one of the mentors I had, which was Captain Collins. Art Collins was my SPC when I was going through the basic school. And he gave.
When did you go through the basic school?
I was Bravo 92-93.
Okay.
That's right. Yeah, Bravo 92-93. Briefcase Bravo.
Uh-huh.
but we were. He was just talking about life, the universe, and everything. And he said, you know, in your career, you should do three things in the Marine Corps. You should lead, teach, or learn. And he just kind of said that as a side, but it really stuck with me. And what I did with the rest of my career is I tried to do that. I tried to either be leading Marines, be in school, or be on the platform. So I ended up doing numerous platform tours. And those platform tours were generally focused in the area of developing younger Marines and sailors, or soldiers and airmen when I was teaching in a coalition environment. And what I found was, as I was teaching, and I learned as I was teaching how important leadership was, because leadership is not the same for everybody. And leadership is not the same for every organization. But I think Marines in the military environment do it best. So I spent a lot of time doing exactly what you're talking about, teaching leadership and decision making to soldiers, to airmen, and to sailors who were not necessarily steeped in that same type of decision making process. So what I think the most important thing a leader does is make a decision. Otherwise, they're just a participant. So, and the reason that the military has a rank structure is, somebody's got to stand up and say, it's time to take the hill. And if it's a captain, everybody who's not a captain, they pick up their rifle and they go. And if the captain's a good captain, he leads out front. But in order to do that, you have to decide as that captain, as that company commander, is it my mission to take the hill? Is taking the hill right now the right time to do it, or do I have tactical patience to wait to do it when it will be, a better opportunity? Are the lives I'm about to lose as we cross the line of departure worth taking that hill and achieving the larger objective? That's a decision that you make in about 4 seconds. And to be able to process that incredibly diverse and deep information set and have it come out with an executable and understandable order is what decision-making is all about. And you're absolutely right, first responders. You know, we don't have a corner on this in the Marine Corps or the military, but anyone who is in a time-compressed, high-pressure situation is in the same boat. Quarterback on a football team. You know, he's got a second and a half to make a decision. If he waits too long, he's going to get crushed. If he waits too long too many times, he's going to get fired. In the military, and as a first responder, you know, it's not the win-loss column that you're worried about, but it's the bodies who pile up when you make a bad or delayed decision that matter. So every decision that you make when you're in uniform is impactful. And it's not necessarily because you said for someone to do something. The fact that when you're a leader, every single thing you do is judged by the people that you lead. Every decision that you make, if you make a good one, people are like, hey, that was a good decision. Okay, I get that. If you make a bad one, if you make, you know, everybody makes bad decisions. I made plenty of them. And if you can learn from that as a leader, and your people can learn from that in that they recognize that, okay, that was a bad decision. It's not a bad person. It's a bad decision. You can become better and your unit can become better. And there are some decisions that aren't bad. There are some decisions you just have to make. They're inexorable. There are times when you have to tell people it's time to take the hill. You know, I have sent Marines on missions where we knew we were going to take casualties, and we did. You know, and as a leader, I was able to, you know, hand on heart, fully be at peace with sending Marines and sailors out to where we knew they were going to make contact, to where they with a very strong possibility that they could be killed or wounded. And fortunately, you know, knock on wood, we suffered about 10% casualties. Fortunately, no KIAs, but we had a lot of guys who got shot, blown up, burned, et cetera. I was able to do that with a completely clear conscience because I knew that I had done everything humanly possible to prepare them for that moment in time when they were at the point of friction. And I believe that my Marines and sailors believe that as well, that we as a unit had done everything and we as leaders had prepared them as well as possible so that when they were at the point of friction where they had to make that decision, whether to go trigger down or not to go trigger down, whether to drop a bomb or not to drop a bomb, they were able to make that correct decision. And again, they had microseconds to make that decision. I had, you know, a second or two or a minute or two or an hour or two to make that decision. So to fully answer your question, and then I'll shut up, I think that the reason that the military and first response is a profession and not a job is because your entire being needs to be focused on accomplishing the mission you're assigned and always preparing yourself mentally for, you know, what now, Lieutenant? If something happens, what are you going to do about it? To be decisive, to be one of those people that when things go sideways, ready to prop it back up and get it straight again. And that comes from training. It comes from experience. It comes from a lot of late nights, a lot of trips up and down the Delta Corridor at CACs or at CTX, whatever the hell they call it these days. You know, being part of an organization, that's what you do all day long. You can't be a dilettante and be a leader in any organization, but certainly not in something that's high pressure like ours.
Mike Rice, 27-year Marine veteran. We're talking leadership and decision-making right now. Mike, I grew up, you know, with a dad in Major League Baseball, and I watched him fight a tactical fight every night with his lineup card and weapons that he had and against another opponent. Sometimes they were really good, like the Cincinnati Reds, and then sometimes they weren't so good, which made it a more competitive game for the San Diego Padres. But I used to watch the matchups that he'd engineer. So I grew up from a little boy with this kind of this matchup thing in my head, understanding capabilities. He plays this card, you have to do this. I get to the Marine Corps, I go through OCS, and I go out to 1-5. I come back to the basic school as an instructor. And I used to watch the uncoordinated, spontaneous flanking attack that would ensue whenever there was a contact, when lieutenants bumped into something. And so I used to watch, and I thought, you know, these guys do it athletically. They make reads. They fill gaps in football games. You know, they make throws in football games or in soccer games, in baseball, you know, as the game changes pitch to pitch, as runners move from base to base, they know how to do that. Yet we don't seem to do a very good job in articulating, hey, there's this period once somebody shoots at you that you have to kind of take your fingers and feel out there. And people have to yell, and you have to then make a decision. And then, and so I'd watch this, and so I go to the infantry officer course. John Allen, former general of Marines and ISAF commander, and put together the President's Coalition to fight ISIS. He's the group chief there. And I said, hey, sir, I want to teach a decision-making class. What do you think? And he said, Mac, I think that's a great idea. What are your thoughts? And so I start laying this thing out, and I'd read Russell Stolpe's Bias for Action. And there's a quote in there I love, that the German 7th Panzers did not create the command and control system that they created because they were free in combat. They knew that in a dynamic situation, decisions were going to be made. Some of those decisions were going to be bad. Those bad decisions could be overcome by additional good decisions in a dynamic environment where the enemy has a vote. And it was creating that environment which created a bias for action, that understanding. But I'd like to just echo a couple of things you said. It's a lifelong learning. The stakes are tremendously high, and the pressure is incredible. And there's audio. There's an interview that I did with Navy Cross winner Staff Sergeant Jeremiah Workman, and he talks about his Navy Cross, and he felt, and to this day he would tell you that he still struggles. He felt that day he failed. They killed 24 insurgents in Fallujah that day. They lost 3 Marines, and he said, quote, I don't want this. I don't need this. All I want is those 3 Marines back. And so, you know, what you're talking about, this lifelong of learning, which gets you to the line of departure, then your head in the game, making reads on the battlefield, reacting to that. If you screw it up, make another decision that unscrews it, and then hammer them and win. That's not an easy thing. And as Mike said, you can't be a dilettante and do this stuff. The stakes are so high. And that's what every small unit leader that goes into combat, that's what they walk in with. And it's just an incredible, incredible amount of pressure. And as Mike's talking, the leadership that you give them, the environment that you create for them, right, to make them be aggressive and not be afraid, in this dynamic environment where you're only going to have 50, 30, 20% of the information you need to make a lucid decision, yeah, you don't get that. And you got to do it now. So I find it incredibly fascinating, Mike, and I love talking about it, and it's certainly great to have you here. Is there, as you wrote in your writings, is there any part of it, is there any one piece of that that you found more fascinating than any other?
Specifically in decision making, I did a lot of studying. I did a little bit of consulting when I left the Marine Corps on it, on a conceptual model that is based on that every decision that is not standalone. What I mean by standalone, you know, you can decide to pay your bills or not this month. That's just you paying your bills. But in an environment where there's more than two people doing something, where you have to achieve some kind of objective, there's really three things that go on in that decision-making environment that determine success or failure. And so I wrote a fair amount about this. I don't know if I published it anywhere, but I had it on some blogs and things. But there's the three components are, in an example, is you're flying an airplane. Okay, when that airplane's in flight, you got three people in the cockpit. You got a pilot, a co-pilot, and a flight engineer for, you know, planes 20 years ago. Pilot, co-pilot, they're flying the plane. Flight engineer, he's making sure there's gas in the engines. That's all great. Well, when something goes wrong, the plane's still got to stay in the air. So you still got to fly the plane. The plane still, that action, the series of actions that you're executing still needs to continue, and that needs to be part of the decision-making process. Another part of the decision-making process is somebody's got to solve the problem. So, you know, we've got to keep the plane in the air, and we've got to make sure that whatever the problem that we have identified gets solved. Another component to that is that you can't do all one or all the other. There has to be some kind of a balance in your application of effort in keeping the plane in the air or fixing the problem. And just a very brief example of this is Flight 401, which is an L-1011 that crashed into the Everglades, I think in 1974 or something like that.
Right.
They're coming to land in I think it was Miami. They get an indicator that their front nose gear is down. It will not go down. So like, oh, okay, what do? They go and they fly a pattern over the Everglades, and they got to see if the nose gear is down. There's three people in the cockpit. Long story short, they put the plane on autopilot. They pull the hatch up on the floor. They're trying to, you know, they reset the landing. They're focusing on getting the dang landing gear down. In doing so, the co-pilot nudges the control yoke, and they go into a gentle dive, about 150 feet per second. They're only at 2,000 feet of altitude. The tower sees that they're losing altitude, reaches out to him, says, hey, you're losing altitude. The point was nobody was flying the plane. Everybody was trying to fix. They're trying to pull the light bulb out to see if it's burned out. The flight officer is down under below the deck. He's trying to see if he can see the landing gear being extended. They just flew the plane in the ground, you know, to kill 101 people. And the reason that happened was in a pressurized environment, they didn't keep their eyes on the prize. So one thing that I have always stressed in making decisions and teaching people about making decisions is that you're going to make a lot of intermediate decisions before you accomplish the goal you set out to do. And if you get target fixation on any one of those, and that sucks up all the air out of the room and takes all of your efforts on that 5-meter pop-up target, and you forget about the 200-meter, you know, horde that's coming over the hill, you know, you may solve that 5-meter problem, but you're all going to die. So that, for me, is something that I've always tried to teach people and something that I've always kept in the back of my mind. It's what now, Lieutenant? That's the emergent situation you're dealing with now. But how does that help me accomplish my objective of actually keeping the plane in the air? So to answer your question, decision-making, it takes a lot of practice and experience to be able to think thematically on multiple levels about the decision that you're making to deal with the crisis right now, its effect on the overall goal and objective of what you're trying to achieve, and then what the effects of this immediate decision, what are the effects, the ramifications and the unintended effects of the decision that you're making right now on the path to achieving your ultimate goal. So for me, what sounds like a snap decision is actually going to be stretched out temporally to be see where it fits in the grand scheme of things. It's going to have to be instant to fix the problem that you have at hand, but it's also going to have to be something that most effectively husbands your resources to accomplish your overall goal, yet applies the resources you need to accomplish the emergent objective.
Mike Rice, our guest, 27 years a Marine officer and enlisted. Mike, we're out of time. Can you?
Oh, my God.
I know. Will you come back next week?
Sure.
All right.
Yeah, just let me know when. I'm doing a little bit of travel, but I'd love to come back.
All right. Well, just so you know, I mean, I've got a couple text messages. One is, hey, Mac, what is Grice doing now? So, question, Mike, what are you doing now?
The 30-second version is I am in Southern California. I'm a vice president of sales for a company called Boost Oxygen. We manufacture and sell oxygen for commercial use. And, kind of living career number two. Living the dream, being with my kids. I spent my oldest son's 6th, 7th, 8th, and 10th birthdays in combat and missed my youngest son, that was half of his life because I was deployed overseas. So when I woke up one day and said, it's time to go home and be with my family, that's what I did. So I've got a job which allows me to keep raising my sons and get them off to good lives and give my family the stability that I, really robbed from them for so long. So that's a longer answer than you probably wanted, but that's what I'm doing.
No, somebody told me that you have a website. Another email says, hey, I think Mike used to have a website where he published a lot. Do you still have that?
Yeah, it's been foul for a while. It's called, I'll have to check it. It's called orderstonowhere.com. I wrote a book about my transition called Orders to Nowhere. You get it on Amazon. It's not in any bookstores. But I basically wrote, as I was transitioning out of the Marine Corps, I wrote a blog three times a week about what it was like to transition out of the Marine Corps. And I took all those blog posts, edited them, and turned them into a book. It's called Orders to Nowhere, orderstonowhere.com. I will definitely go back and make sure it's still up. It's been a couple months because I've been busy doing, career number two. But it's military transition is something that I helped a lot with in the nonprofit space for a few years. And, that's what I do.
All right. Well, Mike, we'll have you on again. And again, we never got to even current events in the Marine Corps, which I want to talk about. But we'll talk current events and also be curious about your thoughts about transitioning. And then as an Anglico guy and as a guy who with three combat tours, and Anglico guys tend to have unique combat tours as they are normally working with our coalition partners, get your thoughts on post-combat related mental health as well. So we'd love to have you back.
I'd love to. I appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Mike Grice. Mike, first of all, thank you very much for coming on this morning. Love talking to smart guys, and thank you very much.
Oh, you're very kind. Look forward to talking again soon.
All right. There you have it. Mike Grice here on a Thursday edition of All Marine Radio. Smart guy. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. More of a, and then when we come back, we've been talking about this for a while, and that is women into combat arms MOSs. Okay. And the Marine Corps did a study out in 29 Palms. It was the Ground Combat Element Integrated Task Force. And so one of the company commanders is going to join me as we continue. His name is Ray Castor. So we'll talk to Ray. We'll get his thoughts on the study, how it went. More of that next right here on All Marine Radio on a Thursday.